Hello once again and welcome to yet another truly exciting episode of Cooper Talks. I keep saying that. I don't know if you find them exciting or not. I do get very excited by the history and the politics and finding out all these wonderful things and being able to share it with you, however many of you are listening and however many of you actually enjoy this and find it exciting yourselves. But hopefully you do. If not, well, not a lot I can do about that. Anyway, yes, so today I'm carrying on looking at a case study in medieval medicine. But unlike the previous two, which were all about disease and death and illness, this one is about a man. Yes, exciting. Yes, this is about an individual who had quite the impact on Renaissance-style medicine. And that's an English guy called William Harvey. Okay, so William, spelt William, and Harvey, spelt Harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y, for those interested. Anyway, William Harvey was quite an important individual for the discoveries he made, which, much like the rest of Renaissance-style medicine, was really about setting the foundations for what would come later in the 18th and 19th centuries, rather than for any sort of changes that happened during the 16th and 17th centuries. So William Harvey, born in 1578, he studied medicine at Cambridge, and if that wasn't enough, he went to probably the most famous medical school of the Renaissance period at Padua in Italy. So he got some specialist training. Now, that was important because it was at Padua that the doctor and scientist Vesalius had worked on early autopsies and come up with some studies about the human body. So he travelled to the place where this was happening, and that helped influence his ideas and thinking. Now, he would return to England because, let's face it, who wouldn't? And in 1615, he became the lecturer of anatomy at the College of Physicians, which was a fairly new institution at that point. It will later become the College of Physicians, the Royal College of Physicians, I should say. But that meant he was the leading authority in England on anatomy, so the makeup of the human body. And by 1618, he was actually a royal doctor working at the court of James I. So again, he's got quite the status and high profile. Now, unsurprisingly, being so keen on anatomy, Harvey's interest was really in dissection and observing the human body to try and improve his knowledge and understanding of how the human body worked. Now, he is a physician, but he's very much on the scientific scale rather than the sort of doctoring scale here. He, as part of his job, and we can see how much of a shift there's been in public attitudes, he would carry out public dissections. Not that all members of the public came to watch these, but certainly those with intellectual curiosity and people who maybe wanted to understand the human anatomy could come and watch. Mostly it was students, trainee physicians, now that that's being introduced, anatomy is being introduced as part of the degree course to become a doctor. Well, a physician. Can get a doctorate with a PhD. Anyway, so he really emphasised the kind of the other side of Hippocrates, not the four humours, but the idea that you have to observe the body. And he really stressed that they should believe in what they saw rather than what was written in classical texts. Now, if nothing else, his biggest influence was probably that he inspired and influenced Thomas Sydenham later in the 17th century to make some of his investigations and observations that would help further the understanding of the causes of disease. But that's another story. So William Harvey's big focus was blood. Oh, he loved a bit of blood. And while he was in Padua, he learned about Vesalius's theory that the veins of the human body contained valves, which is proof that blood flowed in the vein, okay? And Vesalius had actually come up with the idea that said Galen is wrong, okay? So Galen, the classical guy, he'd said blood was created in the liver and that it was in the liver that food was processed and converted into energy, and then from the liver it was pumped through the human body to sustain us and keep us alive and all those sorts of things. And just for good measure, Galen also believed that it was mixed with the pneuma, P-N-E-U-M-A, like pneumonia, but not pneumonia, which means breath of life. Okay, so the pneuma, breath of life. And Galen thought that was kind of came from the air you breathed, but was also your life force or soul, which is why the Catholic Church had liked it for so long. And he thought that kind of got mixed into the veins somehow, maybe through the lungs, and that the veins and your arteries, everything kind of pumped both the energy and blood and this pneuma, this breath of air, this air around your body to give you a life force. Okay, and Vesalius in the 16th century had said, "Ooh, I don't think that's right, you know." And he'd started coming up with this theory that there were valves in the blood vessels, and the valves meant blood could only flow in one direction. And because of that, all the blood was flowing away. Sorry, all the blood in veins was flowing towards the heart. Okay, so they knew the difference between arteries and veins and the pressure and so on, but realized, well, if the blood in the veins is flowing to the heart, that must mean it's the heart that's pumping blood, not the liver. All veins, okay, through the dissections, all veins end up going back to the heart. There's a lot of veins don't actually connect directly to the liver. So he'd assumed that it was the heart and not the liver, and that there were these valves. And what Harvey did, William Harvey, he started to use dissected bodies and look for the evidence to prove this theory. And he would, it's all a bit grim, but never mind. But he'd maybe look at a stretch of veins and so on, and he'd try and pump liquids through the veins one way with the valves, and that would flow through nicely. And then he'd try pumping it back the other way and found that it didn't work, that the blood or the liquid that he pumped wouldn't go the other way. And that proved the blood only flowed towards the heart. And that therefore contradicted what Galen had thought about blood. And blood being processed from the liver. And it was the heart that pumped things and sent it around the body. So that's kind of a game changer in an anatomical understanding. He is offering the proof to Vesalius's theory. Harvey also goes further, and he kind of says, well, hang on. Can blood be made in the liver? Okay, Galen had said it was. Blood was made in the liver, and was a product of what a person had eaten and then flowed through the body to give energy, which was burned up. And Harvey kind of worked out that for Galen's theory to be correct, the liver would have to make about 1,800 litres a day of blood for a person to survive, which he thought was a bit excessive. Okay, I'm not sure on the scientific maths there. Ask a scientist. But that's what Harvey worked out. So he said, well, it's clearly not the liver then that's doing all this. Okay, can't be. Can't be the liver producing blood. And this was the idea that eventually kind of the energy would be seeping out of the blood produced by the liver. So you'd constantly be having to produce enough blood to get to all parts of the body. And then it kind of fizzled out and had to be replaced by brand new blood. That was kind of the idea. Kind of like, I don't know, a candle in wax. So the blood is the wax, and as the energy is burnt off, so the candle diminishes, so the liver would have to produce more and more wax blood in this case. And Galen says, well, that's ridiculous, okay? There's no way that could be the case, okay? It must be more of a circulatory system. Otherwise, you're constantly making new wax. What really inspired him was some new technology. So around this time, particularly in Italy, but also coming in place in London, were fire engines, a new technology using pumps Okay, so using valves and pumps to pump water and build up pressure. And these were being used now for fire engines, okay, sort of early fire engines. And they pushed this along so that instead of relying on buckets of water being passed along a chain to deal with a fire, you could actually have these hoses and build up pressure to put out fires in higher buildings. This was part of the development of urbanization. You got bigger buildings, you got more of them, people living in close proximity. Fire is a big risk. So he's looking at the valves and looking at the signs and goes, hey, a valve and pump system, that kind of might explain what's going on in the heart. So almost his interpretation of how the heart worked was based on the scientific developments that are going on at this time period as well. So he's made this big discovery about the circulation of blood, and he goes on and he continues trying to prove it beyond a doubt. Not only does he dissect human corpses to check it, very sorry about this, he also carries out vivisections on living cold-blooded animals. The reason for that, so lizards, reptiles, things like that. The reason for that was because cold-blooded animals tend to have a much slower heartbeat because the blood has to warm up on the outside. Because they have a slower heartbeat, it meant that if he cut into them, he could actually observe the movement of their blood while they were still alive, while the heart was still pumping, to get his answers. So that's pretty unpleasant and horrible, but that is how the scientific discoveries were made. So what he's able to do here is prove that there are arteries and veins and that both are linked together, that they're not independent of each other. Okay, they're not two different systems. So he says, actually, arteries and veins are linked together. It's one system. Okay, one carries blood away from the heart, the other carries blood to the heart. And he would prove this on living people. So he would tie a tight cord, a strap around, kind of a tourniquet, and that would cut off the blood flow in the artery, okay, really, really tight, so the hand would sort of go all white and it would go numb. Obviously, don't do that yourselves, or certainly not for very long. And then he proved that, actually, if you slightly loosened the pressure, because arteries are deeper, the arteries would fill with blood, okay, so they'd start pumping it around the arm. But because the veins are nearer the surface, and there was still a tight tourniquet restricting movement on the surface, the blood would actually fill up and the veins would start to fill with blood and sort of start to become more prominent. And he's saying, see, so when we tighten it really tight, the artery, no blood in the arm, but then when we loosen it and the artery can pump but the veins are still blocked, the veins fill with blood. And that proved this connection. And he came up with this idea that blood must go from arteries to veins through tiny passages. Okay, there must be tiny passages at the extremities, in our muscles and organs and things like that, through which the blood would go from the arteries to the veins. But these were too small; they were invisible to the naked eye. Actually, although it was just a theory, he was completely right. We call these capillaries today, and it's the transfer of blood. So it was a theory that he couldn't prove at that time, but it was definitely a step in the right direction. Now, when it comes to the heart, again, massively influenced by the idea of the pumps that were being used for firefighting, he looks at the heart and sees it much more as a pump. Now, Galen in the past had said that really what all the heart was doing was passing blood from one side to the other, so kind of left to right, not around the body, and it would go through invisible pores in the walls of the ventricles. So it could just go past backwards and forwards, almost to clean it rather than anything else. And that, yeah, as I said earlier, that the pneuma was also mixed with the blood. So it was air and blood. Now, we know today, air in your blood vessels is a very bad idea. Harvey says, actually, both of these are just ridiculous. The veins only carry blood. There is no air. They're a closed system. No air at all. Air is bad. And that the heart is basically just a big pump. It's not about passing water from blood from one side to the other, refreshing it or whatever. It basically pumps the blood right around the body. Gives a boom, 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 and that's a pumping action to force it out through the arteries, and it goes around the system and then comes back and gets recycled, which is what we know and understand about the heart today. So that's really Harvey's big contribution, the discovery or understanding of the blood and the way blood vessels worked and the heart pumps and disproving Galen's. So what was the impact of Harvey? Well, obviously, everyone rushed to William Harvey and said, you have proven it and solved all the issues with modern medicine. Actually, no, that's not the case. Now, the fact that his arguments relied on careful observations and studying anatomy closely encouraged lots and lots of people to do the same for themselves. So encourage people in England as well as across Europe to actually study things and experiment on them and use living creatures as well to actually observe anatomy. Some people have argued that his book, The Anatomical Account of the Motion of the Heart and Blood in Animals, a very fetching title, they argue that's the beginning of modern physiology and sort of scientific medicine. However, Harvey never saw himself as a kind of modern scientist. He followed the teachings of Aristotle. He believed that the body was designed by a higher power and that the soul was what was responsible for how it worked. So it was a soul that was causing the heart to beat. And he was very much in the sort of spiritual nature, still very Christian in that sense, and didn't think we should necessarily understand everything about the body or how life began or how it was maintained. It was all about the soul and Christian belief. So he keeps that sense, and he certainly wouldn't have appreciated being associated with people who say, all the science proves there's no God. He said, no, complete rubbish. He does, like I said, Thomas Sydenham's the big one that he inspires, but he's encouraged other people to go out and prove and test things for themselves. And of course, he has proved that the liver is not what digests food and creates blood. And that obviously raised some questions. Everyone had known that was the case because of Galen for a long time. But he's proved Galen's wrong. So if it's not the liver that makes blood, what does make blood? Okay, if it's not the liver that sort of mixes food to create energy that it puts into the blood and circulates around the body, how does the energy happen? Where does all that process take place? It raised a lot of questions about how what we eat gives us energy and keeps us going. And people are going to start looking at that and trying to understand that. So it's raising the questions that people try and answer in the next time period. And it does also kind of loosely break the idea of necessarily what you eat determines your health. If you eat certain things, it gets into the blood and that goes to the four humours theory. So it kind of discredits that a bit. Problem with all this is understanding how blood circulates doesn't really help you treat anything, okay? Certainly not at this time. You know, if you've got syphilis, the great pox, or if you've got the plague, knowing that the blood is being pumped around by the heart through veins and arteries is very nice, but it doesn't actually explain why you are ill and why you are going to die and how you might be treated. So in that sense, it was very interesting from a scientific point of view, but actually for medical treatment, Harvey's discoveries were very, very limited. He set the foundation for a modern understanding of anatomy and human physiology and understanding how the body works, but most doctors at the time just ignored him. And some, you know, would be hostile to him, partly because it was an insult. This is a common thing that we come across in the history of medicine and science in general. A lot of people don't want to admit they're wrong and that their whole life has been based on doing the wrong thing in the wrong way. So a lot of people would ignore him rather than accept his views and accept they were wrong. And also, if people pointed out, well, what's the point in knowing all this? It doesn't really help you fix anything. You know, it doesn't explain why someone's ill and it doesn't explain how to cure them. So it's a bit pointless. It's nice, but it doesn't have any practical relevance. And that would come later with greater understanding. So, but at the time, most people saw no point to it as practical application. And so medical textbooks continue to give Galen's account until 1651 because there was no point changing. And it's really only at the end of this period, 1673 onwards, that Harvey's ideas start to appear in university courses. So it's part of this process with medicine. We see it taking quite a long time for ideas to catch on and become accepted. Nevertheless, Harvey's discoveries were very important. Now, why, what made, you know, if we, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of this for the GCSE course, for those who study it, what were the factors that allowed Harvey to make these discoveries? Partly institutions, okay? Had James the First not allowed him to be at the court and practice the college physician? Had Charles the First not gone on and established the Royal Society? Then possibly none of this would have happened. Okay, so the fact that he was employed by James the First and as Charles the First's personal physician, they gave him credibility and the credibility of the Royal Society, all of which allows him to raise these ideas and share them, as well as being influenced himself. So that's a really important one. Okay, Charles and the institutions the government creates in England. Okay, of course, the declining power of the church also enables Harvey to be critical of Galen, as well as to actually carry out the dissections and make these assertions to challenge traditional doctrine supported by the church. If we're looking at individuals, well, this is all about William Harvey. So clearly William Harvey and his own abilities and scientific curiosity, that's a major factor in the development of his discoveries. You've also got scientific developments, okay? So scientific developments in the sense of dissections becoming much more commonplace and useful, and of course scientific developments in terms of technology with the development of mechanical fire pumps or firefighting pumps that kind of give Harvey the inspiration to look at blood vessels and find a way of explaining what he's seeing and to help his own understanding. And of course, there is the broader attitude of society, okay? People generally are more interested in science. They're looking to solve the puzzles of the human body. They're more willing to challenge, or at least not accept, the traditional wisdom of the church and Galen and the classical scholars. They begin to look for what we call rational explanations for things, things that can be explained by logic rather than just accepting the view that everyone's known for a long time or just because someone said it. So that's all part of the Renaissance change. So it's a case study in the Renaissance, and it certainly shows the importance of Harvey, but these other factors that, for those of you doing the medicine course for GCSE, will be able to make links with between the factors. There wasn't really a notable individual, unless we're going to count someone like Galen, a bit old, in the medieval time period, but moving forward we're going to see more and more prominent individuals coming through and making discoveries, again thanks to a variety of these combinations. So William Harvey, if you've never heard of him, check him out, interesting guy, who'll have a profound influence in the 17th and in the 18th and 19th centuries with his later followers. And if you haven't already, check out Thomas Sydenham. Very interesting man who did a lot of great things. Anyway, that's it on William Harvey. Next time, I intend to maybe look at a case study or a couple of the case studies relating to medicine in the 18th and 19th century. Ooh, we might even do something on Florence Nightingale. That's exciting. But who knows? I must plan this and think about it. So I hope that's been useful. Do drop me a line in any comments if there's anything you'd like me to focus on or things like that. But otherwise, couldn't talk there. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening. This has been Cooper Talks. I hope you've been excited, and I'll speak to you again next time. Goodbye.